You ever heard of the TV show Restaurant Impossible? It's a show where this well-known chef takes $10,000 and in a few days, his job is to turn around a failing restaurant and get it back up and running. Another similar TV show is called Motel Rescue, where an interior designer travels the country finding mom and pop style motels that are kind of failing, not doing that great. And she goes in and helps them renovate and rebuild and gets them up and running. This sort of same thing happens in education as well. In my days teaching, I was privileged to teach in a school that was known as Needs Improvement. We struggled with what that was, but we needed improvement for long enough that they sent in an expert from afar to help us figure out what we were doing wrong and to turn the situation around and become a school that no longer needed improvement. If you're in the business world, you want this job, it's called a turnaround specialist. These folks go into failing businesses and they do those things that are required to get the failing business back up and running and profitable again. They typically have a wide range of knowledge about the business world. They come into the business with no preset biases, with no preconceived notions about the company. They just immerse themselves in the company until they know what it's all about. They like intense situations. They have the ability to quickly survey what's going on, what needs to be improved, what the problems are. And in this process are typically four stages. There is the analysis stage. These are not particularly important, but if you want to jot them down, you can. The analysis stage, that's when it goes in to see what are the immediate problems. What is burning the place down that I need to put the fire out right away? The emergency stage is then getting out the fire extinguisher and taking care of that fire. It is dealing with the most immediate one or two problems. Then there is a strategic change state. And that's where now that he is, or it could be a she, I suppose, too. Now that they have got the company sort of stabilized, it's no longer burning down. They develop a plan to take care of the other problems to get the company up and running. And then lastly, the growth and renewal stage, the turnaround manager steps back and says, okay, it's yours again now. Y'all go out and run it and keep it going and doing a good job. Well, our story today is all about an ancient turnaround manager. An ancient turnaround specialist. And I've given you all of what I've given you so far just to kind of listen to his story and see, we don't see a lot of parallels in exactly what he has done and he is going to do when he gets to Jerusalem. The last time we spoke in this series, we talked about the rebuilding of the temple. And we got the temple finished up in Jerusalem. And now it took them roughly 20 years from the time they left Babylon till they finally got the temple rebuilt. And Judah seemed to be moving forward after that, and things seemed to be going well. Judah was still a part of the Persian Empire. So in a sense, they were still slaves because they had to pay the Persian king to be a part of his empire. But they enjoyed a lot of freedom. They were free to travel as they wished. They were free to live where they wanted. Just had to stay loyal to the king. But as you may recognize in our country, Freedom's a great thing if you have good leaders. Without good leadership, you have lots of negative consequences. By the time we get to Ezra 7, where we will begin today, the temple's been completed for 50 years. The Jews have been back in Jerusalem now for 70 years. If I'd been born the year that my parents returned from Babylon, very first year back in Jerusalem, I would be the age I am today when Ezra shows up in Jerusalem. If you think about, if you're my age, think about how much time that's been, all the water you've seen go over the dam. At this point, there isn't any prosperity. There isn't any growth. Things haven't gotten a lot better than they were many years before. In fact, the Jews have slipped back into a lot of their old pre-captivity behaviors. Judah was in dire need of a turnaround specialist. Ezra chapter 7, verse 1. Now, after this, in the reign of Artaxerxes, king of Persia. So again, we're 50 years past the temple being rebuilt. This Artaxerxes is a second Artaxerxes. The first Artaxerxes was the same as Ahasuerus, the king, Esther's king. There's been one king in between her king and now this Artaxerxes. So it was at that time that Ezra, the son of Seraiah, the son of Azariah, son of Hilkiah, son of Shalom, son of Zadok, son of Ahitub, son of Amariah, son of Azariah, son of Meroth, son of Zerahiah, son of Uzzi, son of Berki, son of Abisha, son of Phinehas, son of Eleazar, son of Aaron, the chief priest. Typically, I would have skipped all those names and just jumped a couple of verses. But I didn't this time because of, you notice, Ezra is in the line of Aaron the priest. That qualifies Ezra to be a high priest. And we'll see as we go along, he exercises more and more and more authority in Judah, in Jerusalem. And based upon his lineage, he has the right and the authority to do so. Verse 6. So in this reign of this second Artaxerxes, a man named Ezra went up from Babylonia. So what else do we know about Ezra? He has a book named for him. He's in the line of Aaron, as we've already seen. In verses 7 and 11, we will learn he's a priest, a scribe, a man learned in matters of the commandments of the Lord, and someone who will teach the Lord's statutes and laws to all of Israel. Like the turnaround manager, he's well educated in many, many areas that he's going to work in. He'll become a champion of God, someone to champion for the faith once delivered to Judah and to Israel. He's painfully aware of Judah's past 120 years. He knows how and why it was they came to go into captivity in Babylon, and how through God's graces they've been granted this opportunity to start over. And more importantly, or most importantly, he doesn't want Judah to blow it. He doesn't want to see them regress and be punished again by God. It's during this time that the Jews were absent from Jerusalem and from Judea that the Samaritan religion spread into the area, became established there as an alternative, a counterfeit to the law of Moses and the true God. So the people had the distraction of the Samaritans as well as all the other pagan gods and religions that could be worshipped. It's what Ezra walked himself into, was this situation. Verse 6 again. A man named Ezra went out from Babylonia, a scribe who was skilled in the law of Moses, the law that the Lord, the God of Israel, had given. And the king had granted him all that he had asked for the hand of the Lord, his God, was on him. There went also up from Jerusalem in the seventh year of Artaxerxes the king, some of the people of Israel. As we've taught before, you'll see the term Israel used throughout. Judah did not see themselves as separate from Israel. They were still one of the 12 tribes. They used the term Israel and Judah and Jews interchangeably. In their minds, they were doing this for all of Israel, not just for their one tribe. And some of the priests and Levites, the singers and gatekeepers, and the temple servants. And Ezra came to Jerusalem in the fifth month, which is in the seventh year of the king. On the first day of the first month, he began to go up from Babylonia. On the first day of the fifth month, he came to Jerusalem. Now notice that. Reminded me of, well, now brain freeze. Not Jeremiah anyway. He did in 4 months what has taken everybody else so far 6 months to do. He traveled and came to Jerusalem. For the good hand of his God was on him. For Ezra had set his heart to study the law of the Lord and to do it and to teach his statutes and rules in Israel. You know, lots of people, even today, study the Bible. They know the Bible upside down and backwards, inside out. They know what it says, can turn to all kinds of scriptures. Not nearly so many have had their eyes open to what it really says and been convicted, set their hearts to do what it says. And fewer individuals still are willing to share what they know and understand with others and sow seeds and try to make disciples. Verse 11. This is a copy of the letter that King Artaxerxes gave to Ezra the priest, the scribe, a man learned in matters of the commandments of the Lord and his statutes for Israel. The letter begins. Artaxerxes, king of kings, to Ezra the priest, the scribe of the law of the God of heaven, peace. And now make a decree that any one of the people of their Israel, or their priest, or Levite in my kingdom, who freely offers to go to Jerusalem, may go with you. For you are sent by the king and his seven counselors to make inquiries about Judah and Jerusalem, according to the law of your God, which is in your hand. And also to carry the silver and the gold the king and his counselors have freely offered to the God of Israel, whose dwelling is in Jerusalem. With all the silver and gold that you shall find in the whole province of Babylonia, and with the freewill offerings of the people and the priest vowed willingly for the house of their God that is in Jerusalem. With this money, then, you shall with all diligence buy bulls, rams, and lambs, and that with their grain offerings and their drink offerings, and you shall offer them on the altar of the house of your God that is in Jerusalem. Whatever seems good to you and your brothers to do with the rest of the silver and gold, you may do, according to the will of your God. The vessels that have been given you for the service of the house of your God, you shall deliver before the God of Jerusalem. And whatever else is required for the house of your God, which it falls to you to provide, you may provide it out of the king's treasury. And I, Artaxerxes the king, make a decree to all the treasurers in the province beyond the river, whatever Ezra the priest, the scribe of the law of the God of heaven, requires of you, let it be done with all diligence. Now, if you remember last time, all the grief given by those around to the building of the temple, These are amazing statements, and are going to be, you would think, would be very, very disturbing to the locals when Ezra gets to Jerusalem. Up to 100 talents of silver, 100 cores of wheat, 100 baths of wine, 100 baths of oil, and salt as much as they need. Whatever is decreed by the God of heaven, let it be done in full for the house of the God of heaven. And why did Artaxerxes do all this? Lest his wrath be against the realm of the king and his sons. So he must have figured, I don't want to get crosswise with this God. And you'll remember back when Cyrus first sent the Jews back to Jerusalem. If you read it and don't know the background, it sounds almost like Cyrus accepted the God of Israel. He didn't. Cyrus accepted every God that everybody had to keep peace in the realm. So I suspect that was well learned by all the following kings. And Artaxerxes is saying, if you're going to be in Jerusalem, that's the God in charge there. If you're somewhere else, another God's in charge. But you're going to Jerusalem, take care of that God. I don't want to be in his bad graces. It's also interesting to me that he knew so much about the worship of God at the temple in Jerusalem. So how close was his relationship with Ezra? What did he know from Ezra? What did he learn on his own? Don't know. But continue with verse 24. This is quite remarkable. We also notify you that it shall not be lawful to impose tribute, custom, or toll on any one of the priests, the Levites, the singers, the doorkeepers, the temple servants, or other servants of this house of God. And you, Ezra, according to the wisdom of your God that is in your hand, appoint magistrates and judges who may judge all the people in the province beyond the river, all such as know the laws of your God. And those who do not know them, you're going to teach them so they will know them. When we end the sermon, we talk about some of the things credited to Ezra. I think this is an important paragraph in the king's letter because, again, of the authority he gives Ezra, that you're in charge and whatever you say goes, and you do what you need to do when you get there. Verse 26, and whoever will not obey the law of your God and the law of the king, let judgment be strictly executed on him, whether for death or for banishment, or for confiscation of his goods, or for imprisonment. So Ezra, you've got full command. And that ends the king's decree. Verse 27, Ezra continues writing, blessed be the Lord, the God of our fathers, who put such a thing as this into the heart of the king, to beautify the house of the Lord that is in Jerusalem, and who extended to me his steadfast love before the king and his counselor and before all the king's mighty officers. That is God's steadfast love on Ezra. I took courage, for the hand of the Lord my God was on me, and I gathered leading men from Israel to go up with me. Now again, from Israel, he's talking about the Jews and the Benjaminites. They're still left in Persia, up around where they settled. He gathered them together to go back to Jerusalem. Ezra 8, verse 1. Now these are the heads of their fathers' houses, and this is the genealogy of those who went up with me from Babylonia in the reign of Artaxerxes the king. And so in the next 14 verses, list all the families that went up. And if you count up all the numbers, roughly it's 1,500 men that went on this trip. If you consider wives and kids and single women, there could have been 6,000 to 8,000 people that traveled back with Ezra to Jerusalem. I gathered them to the river that runs to Ahava. And there we camped 3 days. And as I reviewed the people and the priest, I found that there were none of the sons of Levi. In other words, there was no one to work in the temple. There was no one to do the temple service. I've got to find some Levites. So then I sent for Eliezer, Ariel, Shemaiah, Elnathan, Jarib, Elnathan, Nathan, Zechariah, Meshulam, leading men, and for Joiarib and Elnathan, who were men of insight. And I sent them to Iddo, the leading man at the place Casipha. That's telling them what to say to Iddo and his brothers and the temple servants at the place Casipha, namely to send us ministers for the house of God. And by the good hand of our God on us, they brought us a man of discretion. Now, discretion here means intelligence, knowledge, success. He brought us a man of the sons of Mahli and the son of Levi, the son of Israel, namely Sherebiah with his son and kinsmen. There were 18 of those. Also, Hashabiah, and with him Jeshahiah, the son of Meriah, with his kinsmen and their sons, which is another 20. And then 20 besides 220 temple servants whom David and his officials had set apart to attend the Levites. These were all mentioned by name. So now the group's complete. They're ready to travel. But listen to what Ezra's going to do next and consider in contrast the way that we might approach our lives sometimes. Do we involve God in everything that we do, in every project, in every activity? Now, we don't need to proclaim a fast before we go out to go to the grocery or do something menial. But that doesn't mean God's not interested. How often do we invite God into our lives to be not even in general, but to be a specific partner in our lives? Or do we just take it for granted that, well, he's my God, he'll be there? Ezra wasn't taking anything for granted. I proclaimed a fast there at the river Ahava, that we might humble ourselves before our God, to seek from him a safe journey for ourselves, our children, and all of our goods. And listen to this. For I was ashamed to ask the king for a band of soldiers and horsemen to protect us against the enemy on our way, since we had told the king, the hand of our God is for good on all who seek him, and the power of his wrath is against all who forsake him. What an open and honest admission by a guy of Ezra's standing. Ezra wasn't macho. He didn't think, I can do this, I don't need any help. But he had put it out there that king, our God takes care of everything. He looks after those who obey him. Do we ever hold back professing our faith? Because if we do, we'll have to live up to it. Just a question, I don't know. Because it seems to me like Ezra is saying to us, you profess your faith, and then you suck it up, and you do what's required to live up to it. Ezra 8, verse 23. So we fasted and implored our God for this, and he listened to our entreaty. And then I set apart 12 of the leading priests. Now, these are the guys he just sent off for. Sherebiah and Hashabiah and 10 of their kinsmen with them, the Levites. And I weighed out to them the silver and the gold and the vessels, the offering of the house of our God that the king and his counselors and his lords and all Israel had presented to us. I weighed out into their hand 650 talents of silver, and silver vessels worth 200 talents, and 100 talents of gold, and 20 bowls of gold worth 1,000 derricks, and 2 vessels of fine bright bronze as precious as gold. And I said to them, you're the Levites. You are holy to the Lord. You've been set apart for his service. And these vessels are holy. The silver and the gold are freewill offerings to the Lord, the God of your fathers. You'll be carrying items that belong to God. They're not yours. So take care of them. Be good with them. Guard them and keep them until you weigh them before the chief priest and the Levites and the heads of fathers' houses in Israel at Jerusalem, within the chambers of the house of the Lord. So the priests and the Levites took over the weight of the silver and the gold and the vessels to bring them to Jerusalem, to the house of our God. Don't read past that idea that these men took over this job. It was their job. And in a way, had Ezra not done this, in a way, he was taking over something that wasn't maybe for his to do. It's not the same exactly, but it reminds me of moving the ark on that wooden cart and David and Uzzah got killed and so on. They weren't supposed to do it that way. And so Ezra's saying, all right, we've got Levites here now. We've got men who are responsible for this. All you guys carrying that stuff out there, bring it up here. We give it to the guys who are responsible for it. Then we departed from the river Ahava on the 12th day of the first month to go to Jerusalem. And the hand of our God was on us. And he delivered us from the hand of the enemy and from the ambushes by the way. And we came to Jerusalem, and there we remained 3 days. And on the fourth day, within the house of our God, the silver and the gold and the vessels were weighed into the hands of the priest and the Levites. In verse 34, and the whole was counted and weighed, and the weight of everything was recorded. Now at that time, those who had come from captivity, the returned exiles, offered burnt offerings to the God of Israel, 12 bulls for all of Israel, 96 rams, 77 lambs, and a sin offering of 12 male goats. And all this was a burnt offering to the Lord. And they also delivered the king's commissions, in other words, his instructions, to the king's satraps. Now, these were his local appointed rulers and people in charge in the area, and to the governors of the province beyond the river. And they aided the people in the house of God. It's interesting to me, after all we read about the hubbubaloo, about building the temple, and how much the locals were all upset about that. There's no mention here of any talkback, of any resistance from the neighbors, from the surrounding tribe, surrounding Gentiles and pagans. Makes you wonder what's changed. It's been 50 years since the temple was completed. Have the locals all just live and let live? Oh, well, nothing we can do to stop it. May as well just go on with our lives. Have the Jews in the local area sort of become a part of the local community? What's gone on? Thought a lot in my life about this idea that we're told that we are both to live in the world, and at the same time, we are to come out of the world. Jesus mentions these to us. Don't turn there. We're not going to go there. But in John 17, 11 through 18, in the space of only seven verses, Jesus says, you're to live in the world, and you're to come out of the world. How do you do that? Questions for another time. But only to help us identify a little bit with the Jews in Jerusalem, living in a pagan world, perhaps only slightly more pagan, if that, than the world we live in today. The Jews were trying, and not very successfully, it would seem, to live in the world while coming out of the world. Ezra 9, verse 1. Since the day Cyrus decreed that the Jews should begin to return to Jerusalem, the Jewish leadership was concerned about one thing. How do we keep the people close to and following God so we don't have this captivity thing happen to us again. Or another way of saying it is, how can we keep the people who are living in this pagan world unspotted from that world? You know, despite, we'll talk more about this later, but despite what we might think of what Judaism became, everything was done in the beginning by Ezra and the others with this thought in mind. How do we keep from going awry of God and being taken back into captivity? So like that turnaround specialist, he gets there and here's that one thing that's got the whole world on fire that he's got to deal with before he does anything else. Ezra 9, verse 1. After these things had been done, the officials approached me and said, "The people of Israel and the priests and the Levites have not separated themselves from the peoples of the lands. They're not separated from their abominations, from the Canaanites and the Hittites and the Perizzites, the Jebusites and the Amorites and the Moabites." Remember Moabites for later on. The Egyptians and the Amorites. The area was a melting pot of the world. People from all different tribes of the world settled into the area. They have taken some of their daughters to be wives for themselves and for their sons, so that the holy, the set-apart race, has mixed itself with the peoples of the lands. And this faithlessness, even the hand of the officials and chief men, has been foremost. As soon as I heard this, Ezra said, I tore my garment, my cloak, and I pulled hair from my head and my beard, and I sat appalled. Then all who trembled at the words of the God of Israel, because of the faithlessness of the returned exiles, gathered around me while I sat appalled until the evening sacrifice. At the evening sacrifice, I rose from my fasting with my garment and my cloak torn, and I fell upon my knees and spread out my hands to the Lord my God. As we read Ezra's prayer, remember, Ezra had not taken part at all in this sin, but listen to his words. Oh my God, I am ashamed and I blush to lift my face to you. My God, for our iniquities have risen higher than our heads, and our guilt has mounted up to the heavens. For from the days of our fathers to this very day, we have been in great guilt. And for our iniquities, we, our kings, our priests, have been given into the hand of the kings of the lands, given to the sword, to captivity, to plundering, to utter shame, as it is to this very day. But now, for a brief moment, favor has been shown by the Lord our God to leave us a remnant, to give us a secure hold within this holy place, that our God might brighten our eyes and grant us a little reviving in our slavery. For we still are slaves, yet our God has not forsaken us in our slavery, but has extended to us his steadfast love before the kings of Persia to grant us some reviving, to set up the house of our God, to repair its ruins, and to give us protection in Judah and Jerusalem. And now, O God, what shall we say after this? For we have forsaken your commandments, those which you commanded by your servant the prophet, saying, the land that you are entering to take possession of it is a land impure, with the impurity of the peoples of the lands, with their abominations that have filled it, from one end to the other with their uncleanness. Therefore, do not give your daughters to their sons, neither take their daughters for your sons. Never seek their peace or prosperity, that you may be strong and eat the good of the land and leave it for an inheritance to your children forever. Now, verses 11 and 12 are Ezra's paraphrase from Deuteronomy 7, verses 3 and 4. And because I believe these events in Ezra have been taken out of context by some over the years and used to say things I don't really believe they say, let's go back and read what Moses tells us in Deuteronomy. Deuteronomy 7, verse 1. To get the full context, we'll start in verse 1. When the Lord your God shall bring you into the land, whether you go to possess it, Moses says to Israel, he has cast out many nations before you. This list should sound familiar. The Hittites, the Girgashites, the Amorites, the Canaanites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites, seven nations greater than and mightier than you. And when the Lord your God shall deliver them before you, you shall smite them and utterly destroy them. And you shall make no covenant with them, nor show any mercy unto them. Now, before we go on in chapter 7, jump ahead to chapter 20, verse 16. Because we want to find out, why did God want them destroyed? So Deuteronomy 20, verse 16. But of the cities of these people, which the Lord your God does give you for an inheritance, you shall save alive nothing that breathes. But you shall utterly destroy them. Namely, again the list, the Hittites, the Amorites, Canaanites, Perizzites, Hivites, Jebusites, as the Lord your God has commanded you. That, listen to the reason, that they teach you not to do after all their abominations, which they have done unto their gods. So you should sin against the Lord your God. Don't miss the fact that from the very beginning, God wanted these nations destroyed because of the evil they were perpetrating on the world. And they did not, God didn't want them to infest Israel and turn Israel away from God. So now we go back to chapter 7, verse 3. So here's what Ezra paraphrased. Neither shall you make marriages with them. Your daughter shall not, you shall not give unto his son, nor his daughter shall you take unto your son. And why doesn't God want you to marry into their families? It has nothing to do with biology or skin color. Nothing to do with the race that they are. It is because they will turn away your son from following me, that they may serve other gods, and the anger of the Lord would be kindled against you, and he will destroy you suddenly. So what are you to do? Thus shall you deal with them. You shall destroy their altars and break down their images and cut down their groves and burn their graven images with fire. For you are a holy people set apart unto the Lord your God. The Lord your God has chosen you to be a special people in himself of all people that are on the face of the earth. So with all that background, and Ezra knows this well, it's no wonder Ezra's upset. Now, unlike the story of Ruth, who was a Moabite on Ezra's list, but yet Boaz, an Israelite, married her. Because Ruth accepts the God of Israel. Ruth gives up her gods. Ruth agrees to live as an obedient Israelite. As far as we know, none of these wives and husbands have agreed to do that. And Ezra saw the handwriting on the wall. Ezra chapter 9, verse 13. And after all that has come upon us for our evil deeds, and for our great guilt, seeing that you, our God, have punished us less than our iniquities deserved, and you've given us such a remnant as this, shall we break your commandments again and intermarry with the peoples who practice these abominations? Would you not be angry with us until you consumed us, so there should be no remnant, nor any to escape? O Lord, the God of Israel, you are just. We are left a remnant that has escaped, and as it is today, behold, we are before you in our guilt, for none can stand before you because of this. Chapter 10, verse 1. While Ezra prayed and made confession, weeping and casting himself down before the house of God, a very great assembly of men, women, and children gathered to him out of Israel. For the people wept bitterly. And Shechaniah, the son of Jehiel, the son of Helam, addressed Ezra. We have broken faith with our God. We have married foreign women from the peoples of the land. But even now there is hope in Israel in spite of this. Again, as we talked last time, it's amazing to me how quickly the people turned. The last time, it was like in a couple of days, everyone turned. And they got back to work building the temple. This time, it's almost immediate that the people are willing to repent and turn and do what Ezra tells them to do. Therefore, let us make a covenant with our God to put away all these wives and their children, according to the counsel of my Lord, and of those who tremble at the commandment of our God, and let it be done according to the law. Arise, Ezra, for it is your task. It's why God brought you here, Ezra, and we are with you, so be strong and do this. And Ezra arose and made the leading priests and Levites and all Israel take an oath that they would do as had been said. So they took the oath. Then Ezra withdrew from before the house of God, and he spent the night neither eating bread nor drinking water, for he was mourning over the faithlessness of the exiles. And a proclamation was made throughout Judah and throughout Jerusalem to all the returned exiles that they should assemble at Jerusalem. And that if anyone did not come within 3 days by order of the officials and the elders, all of his property should be forfeited. Think back to what the king had written in his letter giving Ezra authority to do. And he himself banned from the congregation of the exiles. Then all the men of Judah and Benjamin assembled at Jerusalem within 3 days. It was the ninth month and the 20th day of the month, and all the people sat in the open square before the house of God, trembling because of the matter and also because of the heavy rain. They were cold and wet, and they were scared. And Ezra the priest stood up and said to them, "You've broken faith. You've married these foreign women, and so you've increased the guilt of Israel. Now then, make confession to the Lord, the God of our fathers, and do his will. Separate yourself from the people of the land and from the foreign wives." And then all the assembly answered with a loud voice and said, "It is so. We must do as you have said. But the people are many, and it is a time of heavy rain. We cannot stand in the open. Nor is this task for one day or for two, for we have greatly transgressed in this matter. Let our officials stand for the whole assembly. Let our cities who have taken foreign wives come at appointed times, and with them the elders and judges of every city, until the fierce wrath of our God over this matter is turned away from us." Now, I don't know, but it could be that some of their wives and or husbands had actually converted, had become God-fearing people. And is that part of why it might take as long as it did to come before the elders and the judges to decide who needed to separate and who didn't? I don't know, but just a thought as to why it might have taken that long. Then the returned exiles did so, and Ezra the priest selected men, heads of fathers' houses, according to their fathers' houses, each of them designated by name. On the first day of the 10th month, they sat down to examine the matter. By the first day of the first month, they had come to the end of all the men who had married foreign women, and vice versa, I would assume. It took them 2 months to go through and examine every marriage and to make these decisions. Ezra had now been in Jerusalem for about 7 months. He left Babylon almost exactly a year earlier. We get to verse 18. Now there were found some of the sons of the priests who had married foreign women, and they pledged themselves to put away their wives as well. And their guilt offering was a ram of the flock for their guilt. The remainder of the chapter to the end of the book is a list of all the priests and the Levites who had taken foreign wives. And the book ends with the final resolution of the matter. Lest you think the turnaround specialist was done, it was only the beginning. The book of Malachi was written during this time. The book of Malachi that we read today was written for the Jews at the time of Ezra, give or take, over a span of a few years here, but some, as best they can figure out during that time. In response to all these outside influences, the backsliding of the people, Ezra moved to try to stabilize the religious and spiritual lives of the Jews there in Judah. The major accomplishments or the things that Ezra did are not recorded for us in Scripture. They're not chronicled there. They're described in Jewish history, in Jewish history books, in their history of their own people. When you study into Ezra's life as what is written, he had three motivating factors for the things that he began to do in the area. He saw there's a great lack of knowledge of the scriptures in the people. And the people had no sense of urgency to follow them, to obey them. Recall why he came in the first place, to teach people about the laws of God and to do them. Secondly, he saw that there was no authoritative person or body to guide the religious lives of the people. There wasn't a structure set up to where somebody's in charge. If they want to bring in some false idea, there's no one to stop it. Thirdly, he recognized that the Jews were spread throughout the kingdom. So one of the first things Ezra did was to establish what came to be called the Great Assembly. The Great Assembly was made up of Ezra as its head, and he chose upwards of 120 men, learned Jewish men, as its members. Many were priests, some were prophets, some were Levites, even a small number of what might be called common people. With this organization, and again, this fits right in with a turnaround specialist in the letter that was written by Artaxerxes, not to mention Ezra's authority as in the line of Aaron. They took charge of how things were done at the temple, every aspect of worship, and they were the ones who said, that's not in Scripture. We're not doing that. That's in Scripture. That's what we'll do. They were the forerunners of what became, what morphed into the Sanhedrin, the time of Jesus. The Israeli Knesset, even today, is modeled somewhat after Ezra's Great Assembly. But like I say, their primary job was to make sure that every act of worship of God was scripturally accurate, was centered on the temple, and had to be approved by Ezra and the Great Assembly. Ezra and the Great Assembly set out to accomplish four other things, among many they did. First was to canonize Scripture. They canonized the Old Testament. After Malachi, it was believed that He was the last inspired prophet, and the concern was somebody else will come along later on, claim to be inspired, and the way these people are, if he's not inspired and he teaches all kinds of wrong stuff, the people will go off and follow him. So we're going to set it down right now. Here's the, and to this day, the Old Testament is as we see it. They set up the number of books, the order they'd come in, the groupings, and so on. Secondly, they begin to write down all the oral law. They use Leviticus 18, 26 through 30 as a basis for doing this. These writings became what we know today as the Mishnah. Third, they developed a book of Jewish prayers, or prayers and blessings. It was designed to be used both in the temple and in the home and wherever Jews settled around the world. It was designed to tie Jews together, wherever they were, to all their other brethren. They use Hosea 14, verses 1 and 2 as their motivation for doing this. It says, "Return, O Israel, to the Lord your God, for you have stumbled in your iniquity. Take with you words and return unto the Lord, saying to him, forgive all iniquity and accept that which is good. So will we render our bullocks the offerings of our lips." So you may or may not agree with their interpretation, but that was the motivation for the Jewish book of prayer. And in fact, the Jewish book of prayer that's used today in synagogues and in homes around the world traces itself back to that original idea, that original book written. The fourth major thing that Ezra and the assembly did was to build a permanent calendar. They were the ones that added the leap year. I don't know if you know it or not, but God's calendar being on a monthly cycle and the world's calendar being on a solar cycle, the two don't line up except for every 19 years. If you just go by 12 lunar months in a year, you are 11 and a quarter days short of a solar year. And if you keep this up for very long, you've got Passover in December. So you've got to have some way to even up the 19-year, even up the years. So Ezra and the assembly inserted the leap years seven times every 19 years. Interesting side note, from the Talmud, you can read the tradition that says, goes back to Mount Sinai, that a lunar month is exactly 29.53059 days. NASA scientists in recent years have discovered that a lunar month is 29.530588, or rounds off to 59 days long. Interesting. There were other things that Ezra is credited for doing we won't go into. And I know it's not Ezra's fault, but all the things that he began in these days in Jerusalem are what morphed in over the next several hundred years into what's modern day Judaism. All the controls set in place by Ezra were simply designed to keep the people focused on God and prevent another Babylonian captivity. A noble motive. Unfortunately, give man time and he messes things up. After this, Ezra slips into the background from a scriptural standpoint. We don't hear from him very much. Malachi and Nehemiah, they've yet to be heard from. And that's where we go next if we continue this series to Malachi.